accomplish that? My background is in research flow cytometry. I've been doing that for about 15 years. It was only 13 years ago that I was in the same position that you guys are in now, learning about oncology for scientists. And back in those days, flow cytometry wasn't as common as it is right now. But since then, a lot of advancements have been made, and people have been doing a lot with flow cytometry as far as understanding hematologic malignancy is concerned. And like Dr. Block said, it is an integral part of understanding heme malignancies, which is a big part of what Roswell Park does. We're a pretty busy lab. We get about 7,000 samples a year that come through the doors, primarily leukemias and lymphomas, myelomas. We do a lot of stem cell testing. We'll talk about all of these elements and then some, and how flow cytometry impacts the directions in which cancer patients receive their treatments and the things that we do for the hospital. There's a lot to know about flow cytometry. It's really complicated. It's taken me 15 years to figure it out from an applications perspective and then also clinically. So some of the biggest complications in flow cytometry are the logistics that are involved surrounding how the technology is used to measure the cells. So it's unavoidable that there'll be a little bit of discussion about the technology and its application. I'm not going to test you heavily on the fundamentals of flow cytometry. That's for a different class. Really, what I want you to walk away from today with is an understanding of how flow is applied to the diagnosis of malignancy and to the treatment of the patient. Also, I know that there are a couple of you that were in PTR 536, so some of these slides will be a little bit redundant. Hopefully, you are enthusiastic about that for having an opportunity to hear it a second time, but I have tried to steer away from the content that was delivered during that lecture and develop some new material for today. So we're going to take a 30,000-foot overview of what flow cytometry is. And it's a kind of a strange word the first time I heard it. Like I said, it was about 15 years ago. And how many of you guys have heard about flow cytometry? You familiar? You savvy? Yeah? You do flow cytometry right now? Lots of you? Good, good. So you've taken the training courses with Kitty and been up and running on a cytometer. So fortunately, we won't have to go into too much background about how a flow cytometer works. But essentially, what it accomplishes is it measures cells in suspension one at a time so that when they're interrogated, you can make measurements on the cell. And the measurements that are performed are generally in the form of fluorescence. And there are a myriad of fluorescent reagents that can be used to label the cell. Most of the time, these are antibodies that are tagged with fluorochromes. And these fluorochromes have a whole spectrum of fluorescence in which they emit. You can typically, on an instrument that we have here at the Institute, measure up to about 18 fluorescence characteristics, two different scatter characteristics. We'll talk about the differences between what those two measurements accomplish. And some of the fancier research instruments, you can get up to 50 or 100 different measurements made simultaneously. So three parts of flow cytometry we'll talk about in the next slide, but essentially what we want to do is generate a fluid stream so that those cells can go single file, interrogated with a light source, and then a measurement is performed. This is what a flow cytometer looks like for those who are uninitiated and have never been in the flow lab, which is incidentally right around the corner. Three main systems, fluidics, optics, and electronics. We'll give a brief description of what those all accomplish. The first is the fluidic system, which is the major driver of how the cells are put through the instrument. Essentially, pressurized air is going to be used to take a container of sheath fluid, is what it's called. It's essentially saline solution. It's an isoosmotic buffer that the cells would find quite pleasing. You know, if you put them in water, they may blow up if they're not fixed because of osmotic imbalance. But essentially, this salt solution is then pushed through a fluidics conveyor belt. It's a regulated environment so that the pressure doesn't get too high and that it's sufficiently high so that a important property of the fluidic system is maintained, and that's what we call hydrodynamic focusing. The other part of the fluidic system is delivering the sample into what we call the flow cell. For those of you who have done protein work, you have probably used a spectrophotometer. This is a fancy spectrophotometer in that it has like a quartz interrogation point where light is going to go through and where light is going to be measured. The important part of the fluidic system, I think the most important part, is where the sample is injected into the fluidic system onto that conveyor belt. And I mentioned in the last slide this hydrodynamic focusing that happens, where a sample which is relatively heterogeneous in distribution, you've just got all of these cells in a tube, are then being loaded into the center of this stream and then focused into the core stream so that they can be interrogated one at a time. The laser would come across the fluid stream down from this sample injection point. And here are a couple of illustrations of how hydrodynamic focusing works, where we can take this big bolus of sample and then distribute it by modulating the pressure and to generate a single cell suspension. So after we've got the cells flying through the interrogation point at a pretty quick rate, about 20,000 events per second, we're going to want to interrogate them. And we use lasers to do that, this monochromatic light. There are important reasons as to why we use lasers, because we want to have defined excitation and emission spectra to optimally motivate those fluorescent molecules to emit light when they're excited. Some fancy pictures that really show how the lasers, in many cases, you have upwards of five, seven lasers that are in an instrument, all of different wavelengths, can be steered towards that interrogation point. Mirrors are typically used to steer the lasers until the interrogation point, and that's where the magic happens. Cells are labeled with a fluorescent reagent. I said that most of them are monoclonal antibodies that have been tagged with a fluorochrome. It doesn't have to be. There are molecules that are fluorescent just due to their chemical properties that can embed themselves into DNA. We call those intercalators. There are other chemicals that become fluorescent in different pH environments, different compartments within the endosomal network. The common thing amongst all of these fluorescent reagents is that they have electrons that are excitable, and those excitable electrons will absorb a photon of light, and those electrons will then be raised to a higher energy state. That energy state is not stable, and it is a very transient experience. And what will ultimately happen is the electron will drop back down to its ground state in the process of emitting light. That is a lossy procedure. Some of that energy is lost due to heat, and as a consequence, the lower energy light that is emitted is of longer wavelength. That's an important concept in physics called the Stokes shift. And we can rely on the characteristics of the Stokes shift to identify a individual fluorochrome, each one of them having a different fluorescent signature. And we would measure the fluorescence from a cell that has been labeled with maybe one, maybe up to 18 or 50 different fluorescent colors. Here is an example of fluorescence from, looks like, four different fluorochromes, and we can see that they have distinct emission ranges. Typically, a flow cytometer works in the visible spectrum, although more and more frequently, measurements are performed in the ultraviolet and into the infrared, essentially monochromatic light being used to excite them. And then these filters, essentially special sunglasses, would sit in front of a detector, and that's what restricts light of certain characteristics from getting into, or allows it to get into one detector versus another detector. This is an example of the detector arrays in a common clinical flow cytometer, typically three lasers, and different configurations of detector arrays. This is an octagon, and these are two trigons. These are just the same detector, but the light is just distributed to the different detectors using what we call dichroic mirrors and bandpass filters to separate that light. Not important to understand the physics of how it all happens, but that it does happen, and that light from a single cell of varying wavelengths can be dissected and distributed to different detectors. This is how that happens essentially in one picture, where we've got these cells that are being hydrodynamically focused into the stream. A laser is used to excite those cells. A characteristic of the cells that I hadn't talked about yet, called scatter or scattered light, is measured at the same time as fluorescence associated with that cell is picked up through a series of detectors. The detectors that are used are called photomultiplier tubes, and their essential role is converting a photon of light into a single electron that is then amplified because a voltage is applied to the detector in order to produce a amplified electric current, and that current can be measured. So scattered light is a characteristic of cells that is also measured in addition to the fluorescence from a excited fluorochrome. This picture illustrates the differences in scattered light for different cells. So here we'd have a lymphocyte, for example, which is, as far as leukocytes are concerned, quite small. Internally, it's not very complex. It's just a nucleus with a rim of cytoplasm. If it passes through a laser beam, it's going to distort the light that it intersects. And if we measure it in a forward direction, or right off the front of the laser, we would call that forward scatter. A small cell will deflect light in the forward direction just a little bit. Because it's not internally complex, it doesn't have a lot of things inside of it to reflect light. It doesn't scatter light around. I like to use an analogy of liquor. Let's say, for example, you had a bottle of vodka and you shined a laser through it. It would pretty much go straight through. I don't know if you guys are old enough to remember Goldschlager, but that was a big thing when I was in college, where they had all these gold flecks inside the booze. And imagine shining a light through a bottle of Goldschlager. It would be like a disco ball, right? Dance Party USA. And you'd have scattered light all over the place, and that's what happens with cells that are internally complex. Let's use a different type of a cell as an example. This is a polymorphonuclear cell, like a neutrophil or a granulocyte. Here we can see it's bigger. It's going to scatter light in the forward direction to a much larger degree, and because it has all those granules and internal complexity, namely in the form of the nuclear content, it has high side scatter. So we can take those characteristics of different cells, and when we plot one of those characteristics against another, we can resolve different patterns when we evaluate the data. For example, in a preparation of peripheral blood, we'd see lymphocytes, monocytes, and neutrophils primarily make up that peripheral blood. Lymphocytes, being small and not internally complex, would have low measures of forward and side scatter. By comparison, a monocyte, which is a little bit larger, has some more complexity to its nucleus, some vacuolization in the cytoplasm. It's going to have more forward and more side scatter, and we could go through the different leukocyte subsets and see that they're well resolved as far as scattered light is concerned. If we wanted to measure fluorescence on a cell, it's not too hard. Essentially, all the legwork was done in 1969 when Kohler and Milstein developed the monoclonal antibody. You can use polyclonal antibodies as well, but traditionally what we would do is look for a specificity of an epitope. Like, let's say, for example, we wanted to measure the T cell receptor. There are antibodies that are directed against the alpha beta T cell receptor or the gamma delta T cell receptor, and you could use a fluorescently labeled antibody to measure that. So essentially what we're going to do is take a cell. In this case, we've got a couple of different epitope determinants on the cell, maybe some intracellular things that you want to measure, like cytokine production, and then we're going to treat that cell. In some cases, you have to stimulate the cell to produce the intracellular cytokines, but then incubate it with an array of antibodies that each have a different fluorescent molecule attached to them. It's important that you add those antibodies at supersaturating levels so that you can assure yourself that all of the epitopes have been bound and that there will be excess antibody that doesn't bind to the cell. You'll then wash away any of the unbound antibodies and then use a fixing reagent. Typically, that's formaldehyde that's used to fix the antibody to the cell or to the epitope, because this interaction is non-covalent ordinarily. And if you let a unfixed cell sit around with labeled antibodies for too long, they'll eventually fall off. There's an on rate and an off rate associated with that interaction. So the fixative is going to allow you to preserve the measurement of those antigens. If you wanted to look inside the cell, you'd have to permeabilize it with a saponin or a detergent, and then you could use antibodies against intracellular epitopes, wash away anything that's unbound, and then you can make some fluorescence measurements. This is what a fluorescent measurement would look like. In the simplest form, it represents a single parameter histogram, and it would be like measuring the height of people in this room. You're going to have some people that are a little shorter, some people a little bit taller, but generally that data would be normally distributed for the most part, what we would call Gaussian data. If we were to measure the fluorescence of an unlabeled cell, it has an internal autofluorescence. There are molecules within a cell that do fluoresce when you excite it with a laser. organic compounds and things of this nature, but that cell would then have a baseline level of fluorescence, and the more fluorescent molecules we added to that cell, you can see the brighter it will become. So essentially on the left end of a single parameter plot is going to be low fluorescence, and on the right hand side is going to be high fluorescence. That data doesn't have to have just a single normal distribution. It could be bimodally distributed. There could be all sorts of patterns that are evidenced dependent on the epitope expression profile of the cells that are being interrogated. So one of the real advantages of flow cytometry is that we can make measurements in what we call a simultaneous and correlated manner. We can measure multiple parameters at the same time from the same cell and correlate the data from all of those measurements together and combine them to perform evaluations of co-expression. For example, on this axis where we're measuring CD3, which is a prototypic marker for T cells, we can see that there are negative events and positive events. On the y-axis where we're measuring CD4, which is a subset of T cells, these would be CD4 negatives, intermediate, and high. Here we can distinguish two populations. Here we can distinguish three populations. When we combine them, we now see that there are four. That is a concept that we would call synergy, where you get more out of the combined efforts of the independent parts than the parts by themselves. And we can resolve a number of populations. Does everybody see how these populations can be combined together, and you could use two single parameter plots to generate a bivariate plot? So that'll be important moving forward. Here, for example, is how flow cytometric data is typically represented. We're measuring three antigens, CD3, CD4, and CD8. CD3, of course, on T cells, and CD4 and 8, subsetting those into T helper and cytolytic T cells. And in flow cytometry, we rely on these colors that are assigned through analysis software to identify different populations in the analysis space. For example, for these CD3 positive cells that are also CD4 positive cells, in the software, we've colored them green. And it's true that on any plot that has CD4, those positive events are also green. It is also true, however, on a plot that doesn't even have CD4, you could find those CD4 positive T cells by looking for the green color. And if you went through, you could chart each one of these cell distributions through the fluorescent space. We can rely on these fluorescently labeled antibodies to interrogate all of the cells of a sample. Typically, in the clinical lab, we're looking at either peripheral blood or bone marrow samples, pretty much any sample that can be put into a liquid suspension. But we would be interested in describing hematopoiesis in that patient sample. And through a different combination of markers, we can characterize each of those cellular subsets. So that's my background spiel. Let's talk about flow cytometry and how it's applied to the diagnosis of disease. And some smart guy, Bruce Davis, said that flow cytometry is an indispensable tool for the diagnosis, classification, staging, and monitoring of hematologic neoplasm. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One, aside from having to invest in the instrument, which is several hundred thousands of dollars, once you have that, it's relatively cost-effective to perform a number of measurements on a sample. You really don't need all that much specimen in order to do flow cytometry, and you can get a lot of diagnostically valuable information from that specimen. And because it's a high parametricity measurement that's done in a simultaneous and correlated manner, we can ask a lot of questions, answer a lot of questions as well from the same data set. And that's important when it comes to heme malignancies because they're very hard to characterize. You can take a solid tumor out of a body and say, oh, this is a solid tumor. This doesn't really belong here. And you can do some IHC, and you can figure out what that tumor is all about. But heme malignancies are complicated. They typically are systemic diseases that can present themselves in a number of different places, involving a number of different sites. It could be in the marrow. It could be in the blood. In the cerebrospinal fluid, for example, it can advance. Not only that, but patients that present with heme malignancies typically have what we would call general constitutive symptoms, right? These are fatigue, fever, and weight loss. I woke up this morning with fatigue, fever, and weight loss. That doesn't mean I've got leukemia, though. So it's a useful tool for people who have these highly variable symptoms, and in particular, flow cytometry is useful for evaluating people with these conditions. Those that have high white blood cell counts or low white blood cell counts. These are the specific medical terms that are associated with each of those conditions. Or what's also important are perturbed white blood cells. In other words, aberrant antigen expression or the aberrant development of hematopoiesis, which we would call dyspoiesis. I mentioned some of the specimen types that we would ordinarily interrogate: blood, marrow, CSF, and fluid, but of course anything that you can get into a fluid stream, into suspension. That includes solid tumors. We used to do a lot more solid tumor flow cytometry about a decade ago. Not that common now in the clinical environment, but more so in the research environment. That really just requires disaggregation of the tumor through mechanical or enzymatic means. So these are the sorts of things that we would typically look for in specimens. Basically, we would expect that a sample should have a certain characteristic. It should have a certain composition. Peripheral blood, for example, has about 70% neutrophils, maybe 5 or 10% monocytes, maybe 25, 30% lymphocytes. Anything outside of those specifications is suspect. If you suddenly have 30% monocytes, that may be an issue. It could be a monocytosis, could be an AML. So we're going to want to look for stuff like that. We're definitely interested in seeing whether or not there's abnormal antigen expression on the cells that we're measuring, or whether those expression levels are higher or lower than we would expect them to be, which could implicate upregulation of a particular antigen. Unexpected populations in a tissue where they shouldn't be. For example, blasts in the blood. Blasts are cells that are normally live in the bone marrow, and these are the cell types that, in the case of myeloid blasts or in the hematogones, would repopulate different elements of the hematopoietic system. They really shouldn't be in the blood. If you see them there, that's a problem. And also, clonality is going to be a big thing that we're looking for, especially when it comes to B cells, which is a very common heme malignancy. About 85% of the lymphocytic leukemia is going to be B cell origin, and that's just due to the nature of the B cells as they develop through their normal program. There's just a lot of things happening in their progression. That typically manifests itself as a restriction in the light chains of the B cell receptor that are evident on the surface of the cell. Okay, so we'll use flow cytometry to diagnose disease, but also there are a number of important roles that flow cytometry has after the diagnosis occurs, right? Staging of the disease is important to see how far it's gotten. If it is a leukemia that typically starts out in the marrow, if it's now evident in the blood, that means something different than if it's isolated to just a focal spot in the marrow. If it now involves the cerebral spinal fluid, then there are bigger problems. So it is important for the context of staging how bad things are for the patient. Something that is becoming increasingly of interest here at the Institute and at other centers of healthcare is the use of immunotherapy for heme malignancy or a number of other types of cancer. In hematologic malignancy, typically that involves the use of antibodies that would target specific molecules on cells. You see this nomenclature frequently, the CD. It stands for cluster of differentiation. It's just a standardized system that's used in flow cytometry and in immunology, used to identify a particular molecule or epitope. Here's CD20 and CD52, typically expressed on B cells. These are recombinant, these are monoclonal antibodies that are used to target these epitopes. There are a number of modes of action that are typically used. Either it will promote antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity, illustrated over here, where the antibody binds to the epitope and a cytolytic T cell or an NK cell will be involved in the destruction of that cell through Fc-mediated binding. Or the antibody itself is conjugated to some sort of a drug or a toxin, as is the case with these therapies that are indicated in blue font, and they would target a specific cell type. Flow cytometry can be used to assess the prognosis of a patient, and especially based on the state of their disease. A couple of classic examples of this are people with AML, if they have a very specific translocation, the 821 translocation, and they happen to express CD56 on those abnormal cells, they prognostically do very poorly as compared to their counterparts that don't express CD56. in CLL. Another marker that we measure, or a pair of markers, is the expression of ZAP70, which is a T-cell signaling molecule that's normally expressed in as part of the T-cell signaling cascade. If that's found in B-cells, that is prognostically a poor indicator. We're also interested in assessing the response to therapy. Right? If a patient shows up and they've been diagnosed with disease, we want to see how well the disease is being managed by the therapy that they're given, and you would make measurements of that patient's sample over time. And then assuming that remission was established, you'd want to see whether or not the patient was going to stay in remission, to assess the presence of what we call minimal residual disease. Did we knock it totally out of the patient, or do we still find very small pockets of disease, which would indicate that the patient may require additional treatment. Further down the road, we want to determine whether or not there's progression or relapse. For example, people that have CML, they start off with typically what you call an indolent phase. It goes into an accelerated phase and becomes a blast crisis. You can monitor that progression through flow cytometry, or transformation from one type of a heme malignancy to another type. Also, iatrogenic effects come into play. People that are receiving these chemotherapeutic agents will sometimes also develop secondary malignancies. Those are treatment-related, but sometimes can be coincidental. We do get patients periodically with two or three independent forms of cancer, which is unfortunate. All this requires the work of a lot of people. I have a staff of 11 technologists and administrators and engineers, people that manage IT, so it's a big deal having a flow cytometry lab. The Institute invests a lot of resources into it, so basically, like I said, there's 7,000 samples that come through in the course of a year, and managing that workflow can be quite complicated. We are fortunate to have an engineer on site. That means that we don't have to have service contracts on our instruments, and he can fix these things and keep them up and running, typically within just a period of a short couple of hours, whereas elsewhere, a technical representative from the company would have to come out and try to fix the machine. In this clinical environment, we can't afford to be down for that period of time. And then a very important role is that of the director. It's Dr. Wallace. If you've seen him milling around here, he does most of the interpretations on the data that comes from the clinical samples. When samples come into the laboratory, there is a very specific set of things that happen to them. Of course, there's the chain of custody type things that have to happen, where we would accession it into laboratory information systems. The hospital uses Cerner in order to keep track of where things are at any given time. Once you accept it into the lab, it's yours, and they'll know that you've had it forever and ever until you move it on to somebody else. In the center here, we can see that the actual flow cytometry part is actually just a small piece of it. This is the immunophenotyping, the acquisition of the data, and the analysis of the data. The bigger part comes from the interpretation and the reporting of the data. So we would generate our own report from the flow cytometric evaluation of the sample, and that then goes over to HemePath. And the hematopathologist will use that as just a piece of the puzzle in order to come up with a formal diagnosis for the patient based on the specimen, which, as you know, probably ends up in a number of different places, including cytogenetics with Dr. Block, molecular diagnostics, morphology over in the hematopathology offices and laboratories. Ultimately, all of those contributing to the diagnosis of the patient. There's an inordinate amount of effort and resources that are put into the quality control of our systems. Every reagent that comes in, we have to make sure performs optimally and the same way as the reagent that we had in inventory prior to it. So from a lot-to-lot perspective, also from a batching perspective, when we combine these antibodies together, we want to make sure that the measurements that are produced when they're combined are the same as when the measurement is performed with the antibody by itself. We won't get into the rest of the details related to QC, but essentially all of the reagents, all of the buffers, everything that comes into the lab, including the instrumentation and the laboratory itself, in the form of proficiency testing that happens on a very regular cycle, making sure that we're doing what we're supposed to be doing and that we can detect what we say that we can detect, all quality controlled. And that's a big part of clinical work. So once we get that sample through the process, here's what we do with it. So it's usually informative to have a case history and the presentation of symptoms, but for us to generate the data that we do, it's really not necessary. It's helpful. What is more important is understanding the nature of the sample that you're evaluating and what to expect. If this is a bone marrow sample and there are certain cell types in there, do they represent normal constituents of the bone marrow or are they abnormal? There will be different cells in a bone marrow than there are in the peripheral blood, and it's easy to overinterpret a abnormal population if you don't expect, if you don't know what to expect. So the big bulk of evaluating the data is looking at what we call a sample differential that comes from the flow cytometric evaluation of the specimen. I'll show you how that works. It's kind of a fancy way to get a lot of information out of just a simple measurement. And then we would evaluate the composite fluorescence data. There's a lot of it that comes out of a report, several pages of data. And the most important part of that is we compare the data that comes from the patient sample to what the expectation is from a normal or a non-diseased sample. There's a real art form to it. There's a science to it. It requires an understanding of immunology and about hematopathology, but largely it is a process of pattern recognition. We use the saying holes in the histogram to identify areas of data that you ordinarily wouldn't expect to be there, but when it shows up, it's like a glaring flag. We would report the facts whenever we do an interpretation on the data from a patient's sample. Essentially, that is expressively what the marker expression profile is, and we build an interpretation from that. This is one page or several pages of data. I certainly don't expect anyone to be able to perform an interpretation or memorize all of this stuff right off the start. We will start looking at slides comparing the normal condition to the abnormal condition. So this is really meant to just give you, again, a 30,000 foot overview of what we're looking at. Essentially, all of this data in the first couple of rows is from the same tube. We're evaluating four different markers at a time for a lot of our leukemia and lymphoma samples. Myeloma is up to an eight-color evaluation, particularly when we're looking for minimal residual disease. All of these permutations of the data, they just represent one parameter plotted against another, just another iteration of the data, just kind of massaged and re-represented in digital space. So any of these blue dots in the plot can be looked at in any of the other plots, and you can know through the process of the analysis of the data that they are the same events. So what do we use all of this for? Well, this is what we would use for the sample differential, and we learn a lot about the specimen just with these four markers. We can measure the composition and characteristics of the cell populations, learning how many granulocytes are present, mononuclear cells, T cells, whether or not those T cells are activated, the presence of monocytes, and blast populations, and abnormal cells that don't express CD45, which is the pan-leukocyte marker. Thereafter, what we would do is target specific cellular subsets. We would go through all of the lineages of interest using specific combinations of markers that give us informative data. And these have been refined over the decades. So, for example, this set of data from this tube is evaluating CD45, the pan-leukocyte marker, with CD3, CD4, and CD8 to give us a differential on what the T-cell composition is. This set of markers down here is going to give us information about aberrant antigen expression on T-cells and myeloid cells and on B-cells. We can see that there are a variety of additional tubes that are used throughout here. Not important to remember what all of these markers are one against the other quite yet, but really just for a broad picture, we're evaluating B cells. The clonality of the B cells based on their light chain expression. If I had a B cell leukemia and it was growing, it would overpopulate that sample that in which it was taking up residence, and what normally should be a ratio of about 60 to 40 for kappa and light kappa and lambda light chain distribution becomes perturbed. Maybe it's 90 to 10. And that would indicate a neoplastic condition. We're looking at antigen aberrant antigen expression on the B cells, the presence of blasts by virtue of the marker CD34, which is the ubiquitous marker, the hematopoietic or pluripotent stem cell, evaluating NK cells. An important determination that we make down here is in myelopoiesis, a very common disease of heme malignancy where myeloid cells become cancerous. This set of data down here allows us to assess whether or not those myeloid cells are of a monocytic or a granulocytic lineage. We assess plasma cells, which are the mature and affinity matured B cells. And then we look at a number of other markers through those additional sets of data. So really just to give you an idea of how we would look at these patterns and interpret abnormal from the background of normal. So I thought that I would go through a comparison of normal data to abnormal data from a patient that came to us with acute myeloid leukemia. This was a case from a couple of years ago in 2015. Reasonably young lady at 69 years old, complaining of fatigue, and she had a lot of bruising. What was interesting about her is that her white blood cell count was completely normal, but they found when she went to the doctor that her platelet count was low, so she was referred to the Institute for some workup by flow cytometry. Also, specimens are going to go over to the core lab, and there they're going to do a CBC. This is the data at a Cerner for this patient, essentially recapitulating what was found when she went to visit her primary care physician. Essentially, if this would represent the normal reference ranges for any particular measurement that's being produced. Red counts are low, but not overly low. Hemoglobin and hematocrit low, outside of the normal ranges, but not terrible. But the platelet counts are very, very low. Thereafter, they did a manual differential, which involves taking the specimen, putting it on a slide, and actually counting these different types of cells. Blasts in the peripheral blood are an unexpected population. They should really live in the bone marrow, and we wouldn't expect them here. A value of 12 is considerably outside of the normal range. Promyelocytes are just earlier forms of myeloid cells, segs or segmented cells or neutrophils. Essentially, we find that we have a neutropenia going on, or what we would call a granulocytopenia. Lymphocytes are a bit elevated, and nucleated red blood cells are elevated as well. So we take that specimen and we evaluate it by flow cytometry, and we came up with similar findings. All of this information comes from the differential that I talked about a little bit earlier, based on the combination of antigens that are used to assess this specimen. In that case, CD45, HLA-DR, CD14, and CD3 gives us all of this information. So we found elevated lymphocytes. We found all of these CD45 dim events, which we normally don't find in the peripheral blood. Typically, any mature hematopoietic element will have very high expression of CD45, which is a common leukocyte antigen. It's unusual to find so many CD45 negative events in the peripheral blood as well. So really recapitulating what was found with the CBC, typically what those 45 negative events would represent are erythroid precursors, or they could represent neoplasms that are non-hematopoietic. So this could be circulating tumor cells that are of epithelial origin, for example. And typically the CD45 dim events would represent blasts. I showed you 4 or 5 pages of flow cytometric data, and after we churned those numbers through, we generated a report that looks like this, evaluating all of the different components of the specimen, T cells, B cells, and then looking at different characteristics of the B cells, for example. These markers would give us an indication about different T-cell subsets. We're interested in the CD4 to CD8 ratio in many cases. If we have a T-cell malignancy, one particular type of T-cell will be overrepresented, and so that will perturb the CD4 to CD8 ratio. We're looking for aberrant antigen expression on the B-cells, and particularly the kappa-lambda ratio, as I had indicated before. All of those are within normal limits, no big deal there. Here in yellow font, we do find some results that are not expected in a peripheral blood specimen. A percentage of CD34 positive events of all of the total is at about 7. CD71 is the transferrin receptor, typically upregulated on cells that have high metabolic needs. That's quite elevated. And CD117 is a marker of stemness that is attributable to the myeloid compartment, whereas CD34 could be of lymphoid or of myeloid origin just a little bit earlier up in the hematopoietic pathway. So based on all of these numbers and what the data for this patient showed, we came up with this interpretation. And it's clear cut. Like I said, we state the facts. And those facts are going to be with regard to the characteristics of the specimen. It's, the counts are within the normal reference range. So there's nothing unusual about a number of, bless you, leukocytes in that sample. But there's a granulocytopenia. We note that there's an absence of those mature myeloid elements. The abnormal population, we would describe it in terms of scatter space. In this case, it's larger and more granular than lymphocytes. That's a requirement by New York State law that we put that statement in. And then we go on to characterize it phenotypically and describe the marker expression profile. Based on this expression profile and what the data showed us, it is characteristic of acute myeloid leukemia, and we would always tell the hematopathologist how big of a population that represents in the sample. Okay, so this is what the actual patient's peripheral blood looked like. Here, when we're looking at the tubes that represent the sample differential, we can see lymphocytes, monocytes, and granulocytes. There's a paucity of granulocytes, right? They have failed to mature in the peripheral blood. We also see some of these gray events here. They have very low forward and side scatter. There are a number of ways we can interpret that data. That could be debris. It could be unlysed red cells. Because it's present in all of the determinations that we've made, we can rule out artifact like that. What it turns out to be are erythroid precursors or nucleated red cells, and those are evident in a number of different plots. Here, this is an important area for us to look at. We'll evaluate this plot of CD45 versus HLA-DR in more detail in subsequent slides, but this tells us a lot about the leukocyte composition. So here we're looking at a lot of the lymphocyte events that have a very bright CD45 profile but are negative for HLA-DR. Those that are positive for HLA-DR tend to be B cells and monocytes. We remember from immunology, maybe you haven't had immunology class yet, but HLA-DR is a class 2 antigen presentation molecule expressed on professional antigen-presenting cells. This population here is totally unexpected in the peripheral blood, and that's where blasts hang out. They're HLA-DR positive and CD45 negative. I don't know why that is, what biological significance that has, but it's just an observation that we typically make of abnormal leukocytes. Down here, we're evaluating the CD4 to CD8 ratio. Unperturbed in this particular case, which is notable because it's not a T-cell malignancy. One of the things that we find in this measurement is the fact that the myeloid cells that express CD13 also are co-expressing CD2, which is typically a T-cell marker. So not important to know that CD2 is a T-cell marker and CD13 is a myeloid marker. On the exam, if I'm going to ask you any specifics about that, I'll detail what those markers are supposed to be for, as to what subsets of cells that they represent. But the important point here is aberrant antigen expression, that these myeloid cells are expressing a marker that they shouldn't be. So that raises a flag. So here we're going to compare just a couple of the plots from the previous page in kind of a blown-up form. In the slides where I show these 6 or sometimes 8 histograms, the top row is going to represent the patient specimen, and the bottom row is going to represent a normal control, in this case myself, as normal as that may be. We can see that there are paucity of granulocyte events as compared to the normal. We can see this population of blasts that shouldn't be there. And we can see it represented in this modification of the data where we're looking at HLA-DR versus CD45. Is everybody able to interpret how CD45 dim population in this plot corresponds to a CD45 dim population in this plot? That would be important to understand. In this patient specimen, in their peripheral blood, we would evaluate the B cells because, as I said, that is a common form of hematologic malignancy. These B cells are perfectly normal. The right number of B cells are in the ballpark for what we would expect. They don't have any aberrant antigen expression on them. In other words, CD5 is being measured in this case, which would be commonly expressed on CLL cells. And the kappa lambda ratio is pretty conserved. It's not remarkable one way or the other. The B cells don't have any other abnormal antigen expression, but one of the things that we do find in this evaluation are the presence of CD34 positive events. And we remember that those 34 positive events are going to represent the precursor, the progenitor stem cell for all blood formation. Interestingly, those CD34 positive events don't have any aberrant antigen expression on them, no CD13, which would, I guess that's not CD13, that's CD11, and CD19 over in this case. Here we're going to compare to the normal, those pieces of data. CD34 again in the patient specimen, again with lymphocytes, monocytes, and a paucity of neutrophils as compared to the normal control. Those CD34 positive events don't express CD10 or CD19, but they shouldn't be there to begin with, and we see that they're not there in the normal specimen. Using CD34 as a marker that we can track through other tubes, there are redundant measurements of CD34, and we can find examples of CD34 in other investigations that are being made. We'll zoom in on a little bit of those. Here we can find those 34 positive events are expressing CD13. They're these brown and blue events. They also express CD33. These are two markers of myeloid commitment. So we know that this is probably going to be a AML. And also they're dim for CD11B. Normal myelopoiesis in the bone marrow would be such that events would start out as being negative for CD13 and for CD11B. They would begin to increase in CD11B, or 13 rather, while increasing in CD11B. They would then decrease in CD13 and then increase. They form this zigzag shape. And so we can study myelopoiesis in just a simple plot of two parameters. Of course, in the peripheral blood, we wouldn't expect that distribution to be there. So this is an abnormal observation. Here are a couple more measurements of that population. Here looking at CD117. Which is a marker of the myeloid compartment. We can see in the patient specimen, again, they're dim for CD13. Here they are dim for CD13, and they lack expression of CD163, which is a marker of mature monocytes. Plenty of mature monocytes that are showing up in scatter space and right here, but we have a whole lot of immature cells that are CD13 dim and 117 positive. That population of cells exists here, right? We can see that that population is still here, but it does not express CD117. So it is further along its commitment pathway. So that's how we would interpret flow cytometric data in people that have heme malignancies. Other things that we're interested in doing are evaluating eligibility for clinical trials. Essentially, using the same patient data, we're going to want to zero in on the abnormal population and evaluate it for the expression level of certain molecules of interest. We talked about CD33 before. That's Mylotarg, the antibody that is used to specifically target those myeloid cells. And in this case, we're reporting out that 87% of the AML cells are CD33 positive, making it a good target for immunotherapy. There are certain thresholds or cutoffs that are used so that patients can be either included or excluded from a trial. Here we're looking at the progression of disease over time. This is the very same patient. We were looking at the peripheral blood in the previous samples, and this is the corresponding bone marrow sample for that patient. Again, a scatter plot. We can use these colors to match up the different cell populations down here and the combinations of fluorescence measurements that are being made, and we can identify that population of blasts that are green. After about a month of treatment, I don't know what the patient received, But in the peripheral blood, we can find no more blasts. It was fairly effective for getting rid of blasts in the peripheral blood, but it was not effective at eliminating those blasts from the bone marrow. Several months later, we can see an attenuation of those blasts, and as time progresses, we can see that there are fewer and fewer blasts in the patient's specimen. Also, note the differences in the scatter characteristics of these cells. All of these myeloid elements in the bone marrow are being destroyed. A lot of debris is showing up inside there. This patient is receiving some pretty aggressive chemotherapy until ultimately all that's left are lymphocytes. So this is how we use flow cytometry to track the progression of disease. Important points up here. So the continuing role of flow cytometry beyond diagnosis, right? The staging, we talked about that. The response to treatment, I just showed you that slide. And then typically what happens is that a high sensitivity test is going to be performed so that we can collect lots and lots of events and assure ourselves that all of the malignant events have been ablated. What sometimes happens is that the patient will receive a blood and marrow transplant. Not every patient will get one. It depends on what's indicated for their particular disease and how the clinicians want to progress. But if they're going to do a blood and marrow transplant, there are a number of ways in which flow cytometry can contribute to the management of the case. Transplants can come from a number of sources, either from oneself before you've received therapy or from somebody else that may be a match. And that's a match in terms of HLA markers, right? So that you don't have immune responses against the cells that you're receiving. That's what we call an allogeneic transplant. In the case of allogeneic transplant, because these people are going to be severely immunocompromised, what the clinicians are interested in doing is testing for the presence of cytomegalovirus or the presence of the ability to defend against cytomegalovirus. It's a very common infection. It's probably 90% of the of Americans will have it by the time they hit 70 years of age. Most of us don't know that we even have it. There are no clinical sequelae, except for maybe being a little bit tired after you get it. So it's a lot like chickenpox or something like that. It's a herpes virus. It becomes a problem when you don't have an immune system to deal with it. And so typically, clinicians will use serology to look for the presence of virally infected cells or the virus itself in the donor or the patient and make sure that they don't have CMV. If they do, we want to see how many CMV-specific T cells are there to defend against CMV infection. And the patient will be put on antiviral therapy until they achieve a certain number of CMV-specific T cells. We use flow cytometry to make that determination. Thereafter, they're going to receive a transplant. Typically, that comes in the form of an apheresis product where the CD34-positive stem cells that ordinarily live in the bone marrow are then coaxed out into peripheral circulation and they're harvested. GCSF is one drug. Mozobil is another one that causes those stem cells to leave the marrow and go into the circulation, and then we catch them, and then we want to measure how many of them there are because the dose of stem cells that you give to the cancer patient is going to depend on how big they are. So typically about 5 million stem cells per kilogram body weight of patient. Afterwards, we're going to want to follow the patient's immune system to see how well it's repopulating, whether or not they continue to exhibit immunodeficiency. Also, we're interested in assessing what we call the degree of chimerism, and that is essentially how well the donor cells populate a patient. And then we follow up and monitor for potential relapse. We're getting short on time, so I'm not going to go into this slide in excessive detail, but essentially what it does is it describes four different conditions for people who either have CMV infections or don't have CMV infections, and whether they develop what's called antigenemia, which is the presence of viral load, or don't develop antigenemia. And the whole secret to this slide is that if you have antigen-specific T cells that can target CMV-infected cells, then a sufficient number of those will protect the patient and they won't get sick and they won't get CMV disease, which could be a very big problem in people with immune compromise in the post-transplant setting. So if those cells are present, then they can take them off of ablative therapy, antiviral therapy. The way that we do that was with a reagent called a dextramer. It's a fancy fluorescent molecule. essentially recombinant MHC molecules with a peptide that would be specific for the CMV virus, and it has a lot of fluorescent molecules associated with it, so those recombinant MHC molecules will bind to the T-cell receptor of a T-cell of certain specificity. Some flow plots basically dissecting how we measure antigen-specific T-cells amongst the CD8-positive, CD3-positive cytolytic T-cell compartment. After we've made those sorts of assessments, another thing that we would do is evaluate the number of stem cells that are present in the apheresis product. This will let the clinicians know how long the donor has to collect for. Sometimes it's a day, sometimes it's two. If it's a really big person, it may take all week in order to collect enough stem cells from the donor so that there are at least 5 million cells per kilogram body weight of the patient. One of the last things I'll talk about is chimerism. This is how well the donor cells have been grafted into the patient. This is a molecular study. Flow cytometry isn't involved in actually performing that measurement, but we do perform some of the support work for this molecular study that's done in molecular diagnostics or now over at OmniSeq. And essentially what we're looking for are the presence of these PCR amplified products in the patient's blood or in the donor blood. Here we're using samples from each the recipient and the donor as controls, and it focuses on the measurement of these allelic constellations, they call them. They're areas in the genome that are sufficiently different from one person to another. Basically, you can consider them SNPs. They call them short tandem repeats. These are just polymorphic areas of the genome that are sufficiently different to discriminate one sample or one person sample from the others. And so here we have three different allelic constellations, the recipient and the donor having a different expression pattern, and we can see that chimerism is established. And that's important. The reason why they do this is because a stem cell transplant is pretty risky. It's becoming not routine, but increasingly common, but that doesn't mean that it's an easy procedure. There are a lot of reasons why a stem cell transplant can fail. Certainly infection, graft versus host disease is another one, graft failure, which would represent rejection of the graft, or relapse of the disease. So we employ something called cell sorting, where basically we take a flow cytometer, and in addition to being able to make the fluorescence measurements, it has some fancy instrumentation in here, a piezoelectric motor, and some charge deflection plates that generate a stream of droplets. And depending on whether or not the droplet contains a cell that's positive for the event of interest or if it's negative for the event of interest, a charge is imparted on that droplet, and because these deflection plates are charged, as it flies through them, it will either migrate in one direction or the other, and we can actually sort these cells out in space and generate a collected specimen. The reason why we do this is because when chimerism analysis is performed, it's more accurate to do that on these subsets than it is on whole blood. The clinical data would suggest that people that engraft earlier or become chimeric earlier do better. This is going to indicate cumulative incidence of relapse over time, and we see that for people that have achieved chimerism or a high level of chimerism tend not to relapse until much later in time than those that do not achieve chimerism. This is an example of what that data looks like. Essentially, what we're interested in sorting out are T cells from myeloid cells. We measure the T cells with a marker against CD3. And myeloid cells, two different markers, CD14 for the monocytes, CD15 for the neutrophils. This is a pre-sort specimen. This is a post-sort evaluation of the cells that went into the myeloid tube. We can see that all the T cells were depleted. Conversely, we see in the T cell tube all the myeloid cells were depleted. We spend a lot of time studying immune reconstitution. We have a pretty fancy set of 8 color panels that are used to assess when certain cell subsets come back. And so the peripheral blood of these patients is measured at specified time intervals after a transplant, and we're evaluating all of these cellular subsets, basically T-cell subsets. These are cytolytic T-cells, recent thymic emigrants. These are cells that are just coming out of the thymus. B-cells, NK-cells, monocytes, and suppressor cells, all of clinical significance. Clinically significant because it's been shown here and at other centers that the presence of reconstitution of certain cell subsets predisposes the patient to doing better or worse. In this case, we're showing gamma delta T cells, whereby those that have a high absolute count of gamma delta T cells tend to do better in terms of progression-free survival and overall survival than those patients that do not generate a large number or an early number of gamma delta T cells. So then I'll wrap things up here. I think I've tried to make a convincing case that flow cytometry is what we would call an indispensable tool in the compendium of investigations that can be performed to assess hematologic malignancy. It is a complicated system that uses physics, immunology, and cell biology to perform some pretty elaborate measurements of leukocytes. It's high throughput. It's high parametricity. It basically does things in a correlated manner. And it plays a vital role in the classification of heme malignancy. The other great thing about it, as you saw with all the different assays that are performed, very flexible and can be exploited to measure pretty much anything you want. I encourage you to use flow cytometry in your research endeavors. Come visit us down the hall. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to stop by the office. Mine's right across the way. The research lab is down the hall. And look forward to seeing you and learning about your research projects. Thanks for showing up, and drive safely tomorrow. Can I get a copy of that? Thanks.